people can sometimes take this for granted. And I kind of want to know, like, and for my listeners who don't have a lot of background on sales, what is the importance of sales? Why is it just so important for a business to have, you know, someone on sales or a sales department?
Well, I think the number one importance that I see, and this comes from kind of small and mid-sized businesses, is to allow the business to grow without an integral person at the center of it, i.e. the founder, the owner. If any business is going to reach scale, it's got to go from that core group of individuals. Some even call them like lone wolves, those original kind of people in the business, to like, hey, if we're going to scale this, we've got to be able to communicate this out. And sales has to be able to take over as a operation, not only an operation and efficiency and technology and all that goes into that, but also with people, right? We have to have repeatable processes that other individuals can handle besides just the founder or owner.
Hello, guys, and welcome back to the Think and Nick podcast. I'm your host, Nick Daniels, and today I finally have a guest in to talk about sales, someone that, well, we've never had on, someone who has spoken about sales before, so really excited for this one. Trey is an entrepreneur who has worked across more than 40 industries, helping business owners and executives to scale their companies to exceed their growth goals, specifically focused on revenue generation strategy, sales motions, and operational efficiencies. He's proven that he can drive results. So Trey, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks so much, Nick. Looking forward to chatting.
Awesome, man. Awesome. So I just thought I'd kick things off by asking, sort of, I think people can sometimes take this for granted, and I kind of want to know, like, and for my listeners who don't have a lot of background on sales, what is the importance of sales? Why is it just so important for a business to have, you know, someone on sales or a sales department?
Well, I think the number one importance that I see, and this comes from kind of small and mid-sized businesses, is to allow the business to grow without an integral person at the center of it, i.e. the founder, the owner. If any business is going to reach scale, it's got to go from that core group of individuals. Some even call them like lone wolves, those original kind of people in the business, to like, hey, if we're going to scale this, we've got to be able to communicate this out. And sales has to be able to take over as a operation, not only an operation and efficiency and technology and all that goes into that, but also with people, right? We have to have repeatable processes that other individuals can handle besides just the founder or owner.
Okay, cool. And as you are one of the co-founders of Scale Factor, in our brief discussion before we jumped on this podcast or the last time we spoke, Factor is an acronym for something, right? Do you want to just touch on exactly what Scale Factor does and the acronym?
For sure. Yeah, so Scale Factor, it's awesome actually that we landed on an acronym. We actually noticed the indicators first and then backed into the acronym. And I know sometimes that fails to work. I know a lot of acronyms that people have tried to use and they don't actually work. So Factors is cool because really it came about from us looking at over 1,000 small businesses that we were helping and realizing that some businesses were growing and scaling while others directly in their space, even in their same industry or vertical, selling essentially the same service or product, couldn't reach scale, right? They were struggling to gain the least bit of traction, much less stay plateaued. And so we started looking at these factors and we came up with 7 of them. It's like, man, these 7 seem to keep recurring. They keep rising to the surface. And then we were able to, again, back them into factors. So find your buyer is number one. If we cannot find more buyers, we will not scale, right? And we have to find the right kind of buyer. So find your buyers, number one. Number two, amplify your brand. Amplify your brand is, hey, once we found that buyer, does our brand even communicate or speak to this individual, or are we missing the mark? All the way from logo through to copy and everything in between is like, do we actually speak to the right people? Third is create new revenue, right? If we're going to create new revenue, that's going to be an essential piece of it. Maybe an enhancement of a product or service we have. Maybe it's a completely new product or service we've never even thought about introducing to our client base. The next is team alignment, right? Factor T is team alignment. If we create this awesome scaling plan, we develop out all the strategy, and yet we have a team that's disconnected from it, it's not going to work. Next is O, operationalize your sales motion, which is really, hey, how do we truly take this idea of sales and operationalize it? Again, take it from a founder and bring it out to now a team that's growing. Repeat your sales motion is the next one. If we don't have a repeatable sales motion, again, we will struggle at best to scale. And then the last one is really scaling through investment. I realize that's probably the one we're probably stretching it a little bit, right? You could just call that investment, but we're going to go with scaling through investments because I think what we found is many times businesses reach the end of a fiscal year or calendar year and they realize they've got some profit, but they're not confident what to do with that. So many of them I've seen invested in something they know what the return is, like a second home or a second boat or first boat or vehicle or whatever it is. And those things aren't bad by any means, but I think sometimes that's the default because we don't know what else to do with it. And so that right there is FACTORS. That's really the seven factors that we feel like are essential for a business to grow and scale.
Wow. Those are some, I mean, to put all of that together, it seems like a hell of a lot of work. So yeah, for sure. I mean, that's pretty much building the everything from the ground up. So Trey, I think we should probably focus on operational sales and maybe repeatable sales for my audience.
Yeah.
And so what are the strategies that you use to, you know, let me rephrase this question. How can you create predictable and repeatable sales?
I think predictable and repeatable sales come from all of those factors. We found, again, it's really hard to say, man, one of these or a couple of these are more important because I would argue you could have a perfect sales that's operationalized, right? You could have exactly the tech you need, exactly the people in place, the processes, the systems, everything in place. If you don't know who your buyer is, you're still not going to scale, right? So it's hard to eliminate some of these and highlight others. But I think when you think about operationalizing your sales, you're really talking about all things that take it from, again, owner-founder to could we do this at scale, meaning could we do this with somebody who walks in the door, who on their resume is a good fit, has the right attitude, maybe even has some great experience. Could I take that person and over the next X amount of time, weeks or months, mold them into our system and process and allow them to go produce revenue? What would it take to do that, right? That's really what operationalize your sales is they're going to need supporting factors. You know, there's going to need to be things like technology involved, but there's a lot of elements to it. I think when we think operationalize your sales, sometimes we think rev ops, which is more the technology and supporting systems of it. It's more than that, is what we'd say.
Okay, cool. And with the organizations or clients that you've worked with, what exactly are you selling? Like what sort of industries are you selling to and what are you selling? Are they online courses? Is it like, you know, I don't know. Is it like, would you be selling cars like in a car dealership? Like what exactly do you guys focus on selling? Does it vary?
It varies greatly. So I've seen these seven factors work with, I'm going to try to give extremes here. One side of the spectrum, maybe like a member-based organization. So some of these nonprofit, right? Not-for-profit organizations that say, hey, we're trying to grow and scale our membership. I've seen these factors play into them and really drive growth. On the other side, yeah, you could have a product or a service type business who is, you know, your typical probably business that might come to mind. So we've seen a lot. Seven factors still applies to both. So,
okay, cool. Sure. Nonprofits. That's interesting. How does that model work with a nonprofit?
So typically, the one that comes to mind, they were growing their association. They wanted to grow their members. And so again, run through the factors, like how well do we know our members? Who are our members, right? Are we reaching them early in the process? In this case, are we reaching them right out of college where they can join association and really learn a lot? Are we getting them continued ed? Are we investing in them early so that way they stay members for a long time? Knowing them is really key, knowing their pains and challenges, setting up products and services. In that case, it's like member benefits, right? Is their way of saying that a product or a service for them is a member benefit? Do we offer the member benefits that are necessary, again, to serve this person? So yeah, it's really interesting. I've worked with quite a few nonprofit and associations, and it's interesting how close they are to a for-profit business. Very little difference at the end of the day.
Cool. So yeah, awesome. So I know that, well, from what I've learned from my little knowledge of sales is that people buy from who they either know, like, or trust. And I know sales is, you know, it's very important to build those relationships when you are selling to someone. So Could you maybe highlight some effective strategies that you would use for building those strong connections with clients?
Yeah. One thing I've noticed that shifted, and this is this isn't a fully baked thought, so bear with me, but one thing I've noticed is when we talk about know, like, and trust, I think in times past, that was someone who it was almost like a personal relationship with. That will continue, in my opinion, till the end of time. That's always great. If that's possible, always great. I think as a business scales, we can connect with them, talk about knowing them. Part of that comes down to knowing our buyer, right? Someone can feel very known, very seen by someone they don't know anything about. It depends on how well we talk to their pain. If we can know them and their pains and challenges better than they themselves, we don't need I will speak for myself. I don't need as much of a personal relationship because like these people get it, right? And if they can support that with facts and show me the proof, I don't need a whole lot more to move. It's like, man, these people really understand me. So I think known is all about, yeah, how well do we know our client? And we talk a lot about that in Find Your Buyer. But yeah, the demographics sometimes are the easy ones, but psychographically, do we really know what their pains and challenges are? Do we know what their aspirations and visions and attitudes are? Do we know what influences them? Who influences them? What do they listen and read to? Like, find the weird fringe things. You know, I was talking with someone the other day and he's like, man, I found out most of the businesses we work with, their children are in some form of alter education. Like, it's not always the public school system. Well, it's like, what a weird fact. But if you know that that's part of their psyche, it changes how you understand them and maybe the way they approach the world. And so I think it's all about knowing your client.
Brilliant. And let's just touch on pain points there for a minute.
Yeah.
Why are they so important in sales?
And what pain moves people.
Just so my audience who I'm just talk to me as if I'm a 5-year-old child here. We don't know what pain points are. So what are they and why are they so important?
Okay. Well, it's built on another foundational thing that I don't think will ever change. People, human beings, we find a lot of motivation from pain. We are a people who likes to move closer and closer towards comfort at every chance we can. We don't enjoy pain. And so because of that, understanding what causes them trouble, what causes them headaches, what gets between them and what their ideal life would look like or business would look like is ultimately what's a pain, right? And they can be anything. Some of them are super simple, right? Very, very simple things. Others are very, very complex. And it's layers and layers and layers. But I think at the core, it's like, yeah, what is making this person's life not as great as it could be is ultimately what it comes down to.
Cool. So sales is something that I actually want to branch out into. I want to learn how to sell. Because I believe that it's a skill that it's a transferable skill, not just in generating revenue, but, you know, it's good for just everyday life. And for someone like me who hasn't any real sales experience, what are the key, I would imagine, like, you know, when you started out, you were the same. So what sort of are the key communication skills that someone who wanted to get into sales should learn or could learn?
Yeah. It's a really good question. There's a lot of them. It's funny. I'll just tell you the first one that popped into my mind was curiosity. I think great salespeople are very curious people by nature. They're kind of always like, oh man, you know, tell me about that. Like, why is that? And I think on the surface, if we're not careful, we can skip some of those things. But if we truly listen, we'll pick up signs. And if you just simply ask, well, tell me more, like you're just opening the door for someone to tell you truly what's going on, what their pains and challenges truly are. So I think like at the root, great salespeople are curious. Great salespeople, I think, are connectors, right? They're just because of that curiosity, they just, again, are genuinely interested in someone in their you know, future. It's like, yeah, what makes things work for you? What's also standing in your way? Like, I'm so curious. So
yeah,
I think it starts with curiosity.
Awesome. Awesome. I love that answer. So I've bought a couple online programs before in my life, and they take you through the whole sales funnel. You go through all the videos and then you jump on a call with someone. And yep. I was actually on a call yesterday, talking about sales, in fact, about a sales opportunity.
Okay.
And they take you through the whole program. They tell you what you're going to get. They ask, you know, all these pain point questions. I'm kind of familiar with the process because I've done it myself. And then right at the end, you obviously the big, the big nugget at the end is, well, what's the investment required for me to join this program type thing. Handling objections. So for example, I hear, oh my word, this program's just way too expensive. There's no ways I can afford it right now. How would you go about handling objectives when it comes to sales, whether it's an online program, whether it's in any department?
Yeah. I can't remember. I was trying to remember who I learned this from, but I once heard that a salesperson's key role is to help whoever they're talking to make the best decision for them, for that person, right? So if I'm talking to you, my sole goal is to help you make the decision that's best for you. Keep in mind, the best decision for you is most likely outside your current comfort zone. So like there's kind of just, there's things at play that will never change, and it's probably what's best for you may take friction to ultimately get. And so if you kind of keep that in mind in any interaction, I think it's like, I'm not here to sell you anything. I'm not here to pressure you into doing anything. What do you want? Almost, I've often approached it almost like a physician or a doctor would be, right? You come in, tell me what hurts, right? I can't tell you right off the bat if this is going to be a good fit for you, if I can even help you or not. Like, let's not even go there. Just tell me what's going on, what hurts. And then I can tell you honestly if I think I can help and here's the ways I can help. But ultimately, you know, you may come back and say, gosh, it's just not worth the investment for me to get rid of that pain. And if that's the case, the first thing I'll tell you is, well, you know, do you want to be in the same spot in the future? If you do, you know, we're good here. Like, I don't think I can help you. You don't want to be helped. But I can also tell you probably what you want ultimately is outside your comfort zone. If you just need someone to help push you into that, I'm your accountability buddy. We can do this together. Like, I'll encourage you. I'll tell you why I think you should do it, the results I think you're going to get. But like at the end of the day, I'm just trying to help you make the best decision for yourself.
Quick one. As you know, the Think and Nick podcast is slowly growing. We've recently just hit 10,000 audio listeners, and we're coming to that on video as well. I just wanted to send a message to say a sincere thanks to our dedicated audience and to all of you who have listened to the podcast. Could I ask a quick favor? Could you just please hit that subscribe button, as it helps to promote this podcast, which means that it'll only get better, the production value will get better, and we can get better guests on the show, which means we can deliver more value to you guys. Thank you. Back to the episode. Yeah, I've been told that the number one rule of selling is no one wants to be sold to.
And yet we all do it all the time, every day.
Yeah.
So I was trying to sell my youngest daughter on eating breakfast this morning. That's one of the hardest sales I'll ever have right there.
It's a constant struggle, right? Every morning.
Awesome. Yep.
Cool. So then obviously the markets that you're selling to, I would imagine, are extremely competitive.
So they can be, yeah.
Yeah, so differentiation is pretty crucial when you want to get these sales out. So like, how can salespeople effectively sort of showcase the unique value of these products or services that you are selling?
Yeah. You know, I think obviously the kind of obvious thing is know your competition. I mean, we all need to know probably who are the common, let's say, top five names we're probably going to go against. Really know them. I mean, again, just like we know our buyer, do the research, dig in, find out. And again, from a genuine place of like, I'm not trying to sell against this person. I'm trying to understand truly myself as the salesperson, what does differentiate? Because if I don't understand it, I certainly can't sell to it or explain it to someone else, right? It's like you mentioned earlier, communicate like I'm a five-year-old. That's the whole point. It's like, if I can't clearly, concisely communicate to a five-year-old why these two things are different, like I'm going to have problems right out of the gate. So I think differentiation is key. I think it comes from doing market research and then knowing your own product really well. Sometimes it's easy things like speed, right? Oh, we're going to, you know, this is going to be a quicker path to the same end goal. Sometimes it's user experience. Hey, our platform or our service is easier to engage with or easier to use. Maybe you're doing more. Hey, this is more of a done for you service than theirs. Theirs is a done with you. Whatever that is, figure out what it is in a real genuine way. And then I've always had success just simply presenting the clear facts of what is different. Again, helping them decide what's best for them. So,
and obviously sales is a negotiation, right? And what you really ideally want is it to be a win-win for both parties.
Mm-hmm.
So are there any sort of simple strategies that my audience could take away for negotiating, you know? Mm. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, I think back to my curiosity kind of point, I think ask better questions, right? I mean, I think if somebody comes to you and says, hey, yeah, we're measuring the options and we're looking at you and three more others. And like, unless you can be here, you know, we can't do business. And it's like, okay, well, tell me more about that, right? What's driving that? Is that you? Is that someone else? Like, is there a certain, like, are you on a bus? Like, I still think just asking the better question is going to lead you to a better result. And then I think just knowing that it is a negotiation, be really clear about what you're able to do. Hey, based on what you just told me, we can do this. If that's acceptable, like, ready to go. If it's not, again, I always say in sales, it's just as effective to race to a no as it is to a yes. The worst thing that can happen is you don't communicate clear enough and you're left in this odd limbo to where you're like, you know, they tell you, I'm looking into it, or we're thinking to move forward. And in your mind, you go, great, done deal. They're probably going to call me tomorrow. They'll have everything set up and we'll get this thing moving.
Yeah.
In reality, all they mean is we're thinking about it. But we are always looking through a lens, right? In any conversation we're in, we have our own set of lenses. Man, as much as we can check ourselves and realize that a no is just as valuable as a yes in a lot of ways, the worst is a limbo. So,
okay, can you just elaborate on how is a no just as valuable as a yes?
Because it's a decision.
Okay.
The point of any interaction, at least in a sales manner, is to come to some kind of decision, right? A yes is better financially and for your business as a go, right? We're going to get revenue off of this, profits, et cetera. But I think too many times out of ultimate fear of a no, we don't get to the answer. And I can tell you, as the end of the month looms closer, the end of the quarter, end of the year, whatever it is that your metric is based off of, as that looms closer and you all of a sudden realize, yeah, there's like eight of these things that I thought were coming across the line that haven't, and I haven't heard anything. You got to look in the mirror and say, okay, what could I have done to be more clear about a decision that we didn't make it to? And so I just think there's an understated value for getting to a no. And then knowing the reason why, right? If we do get to a no, we need to know why we got to that no as well. Maybe it's timing. Maybe it's the season. Hey, let's loop back to this in 3 months. Whatever it is, it's not a good fit. That may be a no forever. It also may just be a no for this month. Like, let's engage it next month. That's still a valuable answer. You know, we can work with that, in other words.
Yeah. So the decision-making process, like, say, for example, I go in and I try to sell something to someone. They say no. That's not a bad thing. They're thinking about it, like you said. What's the time frame on sort of closing a deal? Because I know if it lingers for too long, you lose the client. So,
right. Like, speed kills.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of just want to close it then and there, but you also don't want to be too pushy because then you're going to, you know, they're going to back off anyway. So
yeah,
I don't know if maybe there's an aggressive sales approach that works. I'm not sure. So what is the time frame? And then we'll touch on an aggressive sales approach.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to find out, number one, what your prospect's timeline is, right? Hey, we're having this conversation. When are you trying to make a decision? And I think doing that in a way that isn't selfish, not like, hey, I want to know when you're going to make a decision. But honestly, again, what's your situation? How quick are you looking for a solution? If this is like, hey, I'm kind of just exploring options phase, that's awesome. I'm here to invest as much value as I can, but like, I need to set expectations as well. I was actually on a call earlier this week and it was interesting. I was the one pushing forward and the salesperson was like, hey, I think we need to take a minute here, right? Let's talk to this person. Let's actually find out about this thing before moving too far forward in this. And so I think to me, I can tell you how that was perceived. It's like, this person isn't racing to the sale. They're actually more interested in making sure this is the right solution for the challenge I have versus just like, man, can I get your credit card number as soon as possible? And so I think you drive trust when you can play that game. And so I think knowing their timeline, number one. And then two, I come back to like really clear communication. Like, again, I've found too many people don't want to ask the hard question. They do before the call, but in the moment, in that split second moment, they just, something keeps them from just asking the hard question and getting the hard answer. And I think it's this underlying fear of rejection somewhere that they're going to get a no, or they're going to get an answer that they don't like.
That's really interesting, because with sales, you've got to almost become like extremely resilient, because you're going to encounter a lot of rejection. You're going to get a lot of your no's before you get that yes.
Yep.
So let's
Big on energy too. Like if I'm wasting energy on a deal that's not going to close, or that they're not on a timeline where they're closing anytime soon, I'm the one that's losing, because I could be putting that same energy into someone who is on a shorter timeline, who wants to get a solution, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why I say, even back to the no, I'd rather have that no right now so I can go spend energy on something else.
Yeah, sure. Time is extremely valuable, especially in this industry.
Yeah.
Aggressive sales tactics. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not a fan at all. That's just my gut. I know I don't like to be pressured into things on someone. If I ever perceive that it's someone else's good ahead of mine, it's selfish to say, but ultimately I'm saying, hey, I'm looking for a solution. If you're just here to get a credit card number moved to the next call, that's probably a sign potentially of this relationship as a whole. And like, I'm not interested. Right. And I know even in the work that I've done in previous roles, really helping sales teams understand, again, we are here to help the person on the other end of this engagement come to the answer that's best for them, right? The solution that's best for them. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's, again, it's a balance. I've overstepped bounds for sure. And I'm sure it turned some people off. I've also not been forward enough and lost some deals. And mm-hmm. so I think it's an art. I think you're gonna have to feel it out. Different industries, I would say, vastly impact that, right? But I know, you know, I was previously in an industry that was, I would say, probably pretty known for, hard sales, pressure sales.
Yeah.
And I think coming at it from an opposite angle was actually a breath of fresh air for a lot of people. Again, being really honest with them and genuine, saying, if you want this result, this is what it's going to take. If you need me to stand in the gap for you and say, I believe in this transformation for you, you need to do this, I will do that. Just know that's my default, because I hear what you're saying. Now, if you're not telling me the truth about what you want, then this is going to come across like I'm pressuring you to do something. But if you're really telling me this is what you want, this is the steps it's going to take to get there, you know, and almost filling in like a pseudo coach role to say, hey, if that's the goal you want here, that's where I think pressure is well accepted, because it's like, look, I'm telling you, this is what I want and you're helping me get there. So,
yeah, I love what you were saying there. It's like your approach, it's very ethical. And it's almost empathic in a way that you're really knowing your customer rather than going for the hard sale approach. Just out of curiosity, did the hard sales approach work?
Most of the time it didn't. Not unless it was on those grounds of like, hey, you tell me this is what you want. Is that truly what you want? Okay, great. Then I can dial up the pressure.
Nice. Okay.
But if I didn't kind of test the waters first, or like, that's not the right way to say that. If I didn't truly get their commitment and they were really clear about what they wanted, if they were wishy-washy about what they wanted, then it comes across as me being pushy, right? Mm-hmm. And so it has to be on their terms.
Right, okay. So I just want to sort of pivot to technology now.
Yeah.
20 years ago, before the Facebook era, before the information boom, you would go to a car dealership and you would deal directly with the dealer or the salesman, whoever's selling the car. And this happened to me, because when I bought my first car, he sold it to me and I loved it. So anyways, but that's besides the point. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we have so much, you know, access to technology, data, different tools, different, there's different approaches to selling now, because obviously there's different things that you can sell, products and services. So with the ever evolving technology in the sales industry, how can sales professionals leverage those tools and that data or those analytics to enhance their sales approach?
Know your customer better. I mean, I probably sound like a broken record, but that's what it comes down to, right? I mean, look at the car dealership model. They found out, wow, this whole experience of driving to a car dealership, interacting with an individual who they might automatically feel like, this person doesn't want me to leave this lot without having my name on a car. We can negate all that by just giving them an awesome platform where they can look at every vehicle we have. And if they like something, they can reserve it. They can either come to the dealership and test drive it. We'll ship it to their house. That's a matter of knowing their buyer, right? And probably that was pulled from a lot of data, to your point, survey. I found more information that's helpful for businesses comes out of surveys of their existing clients. Hey, you've been with us a month. What did you think about this interaction? Or how was the sales process for you? Or what could you have done differently? Or I'm sorry, what could we have done differently to allow this to be a better experience for you? Take that and make changes with it. I know companies who do that every single week and they don't go a week without changing one thing, maybe very, very small, maybe something very large. But if we're not collecting that information from clients about their experience and updating our approach, I believe that's the way to use data and technology to our advantage, is truly just, again, genuinely asking.
Nice. And are there any specific sort of tools that you would recommend, or that, because I'm sure you've probably used, I don't know, different CRM systems and stuff like that, that mm-hmm. you find are the most powerful when it comes to selling?
I think there's a lot of approaches. I've seen very personal approaches, where it's literally an engagement, a client success specialist that reaches out and asks these questions, just individual to individual. I've seen that work really well. You've also got those little pop-up quizzes that just say, hey, can you answer two questions? And a lot of people do that, right? A lot of people, while they're on hold or while they're doing whatever they're doing, can answer a few questions. I don't think there's a one size fits all. I think it comes back to the industry, the vertical, the product or service you offer. I think you tailor it accordingly. If you have a really high touch, really high end product or offer, probably want to have a person reach out and have that conversation, right? If you're very utilitarian, right? It's just a utility. People just need it. They're solving a problem. Probably going to follow up with an email with a survey or text them for a survey. There's so many AI powered surveys as well that can literally generate questions on the fly. Those can be really great as well.
Wow. Yeah. That, I mean, it's crazy how technology is evolving, right?
Yeah.
Trey, you've obviously had I would imagine loads of sales experiences, and along the way, there's going to have had to have been some challenges. So would you mind sharing a personal success story, where you maybe overcome a challenge during a sales situation, and then what lessons did you take from that?
Yeah, I can think of one. So it was a consulting engagement where I worked, talked with the business owner up front, talked about the whole engagement, definitely a really clear product or service fit with this individual. Definitely was the result they were looking for on the timeline they were looking for, kind of done all the work. But ultimately didn't ask enough questions in the final hour. So early, this was pretty early in my career. Early in my career, again, I would be that one that didn't want to ask that question. It was just like something felt off about it. Something felt too pressury about it. And I didn't like that. Well, in reality, it was a simple fix, quite frankly. It was a change up in the start date of when he wanted to start the engagement, and two, what we could do financially as far as payments. That's all it was. It wasn't the total number. It wasn't, you know, it was really very, very simple, but I didn't ask enough questions. And so after the deal went dead, he actually told me a no. It bugged me so much. I reached out to him just like personally. I was like, hey, I'm like losing sleep over here, because I feel like everything is in play. Like, we're solving your problem in the time you wanted, with the way you wanted. Like, this is a perfect fit coming from your mouth. You even said it. Why the no, right? Why do we find ourselves here? And he was nice enough to just tell me why. It's like, hey, this is why. Because, you know, I can't start right now. And my assumption, based on our conversations, I understood that I had to get going by this point, or else I kind of like missed the boat. And then the other one is like, we are selling a business right now. One of his businesses he was selling, and he was going to use that capital to invest in this consulting for one of his other businesses. Again, I didn't ask enough questions. I didn't know that. Right. And so it's like, instantly it was like, wow, I didn't ask enough questions. I wasn't curious enough to actually find out what the limiters were and to make something work for him. And so that's just a quick example of where I learned a lesson, which is always ask the extra question, not to waste time, but to truly get to what's behind it. You know, what's the thing behind the thing?
Yeah. You've really touched on curiosity a lot in this podcast. So that's something that I'll definitely take away. I've been seeing a lot of, as I said, I've been trying to get into sales, and I've explored some avenues, and there's been a lot of people marketing to me through Facebook, social media, all the different platforms of high ticket sales closing. What are you familiar with high ticket sales closing and red flags, basically? Because I've looked at all these programs, and I've actually had face-to-face calls with these people. As you said, you know, the more the value of the product, it's probably better to have a personal engagement.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on high ticket closing and red flags, say, for example, someone's trying to sell me a program, what would be a red flag that you would be like, okay, straight away, no, this is not good?
Yeah. Couple things I would look at. First and foremost, what is their track record? Like, do they have not just sort of clickbait Google ad kind of like, oh, this was amazing, you know, five stars, but actually like real customer results? I would look for like video testimonials or written testimonials. And then one thing that I've always used as kind of a measurement is I feel like the high ticket closers that are out there backing up, you know, or selling programs or whatever they're selling, if they're really confident in their service or their product, they'll give you some kind of trial up front. I know that sounds kind of weird to say, but like, if you don't offer me 30 days to actually see what this is about with a full refund, like, how confident are you in this? Right. I feel like that can be a barrier to just like, again, I'm trying to get a payment and get you locked into some kind of contract. In at a time when I was selling high ticket, it was absolutely mandatory that we had a trial period. It was like, hey, not only come in, I want you in the first 30 days to connect with as many of our community as you can. And, and all of them will be willing to go offline with a conversation. If you want, ask them how it's been. This guy's been here 36 months. This person's going on their fourth year. This person just got in 8 months ago. Ask all of them. And if they don't give you rave reviews, you'll know confidently that, you know, this isn't a good fit. But I think when you can back it up with that, those are some things I always look at. Sometimes they don't let you in the program that early. So maybe it's just, hey, can I connect with a current client? Like, I'd like to talk to somebody who's been working with you. So that can be another alternative. But yeah, I always see red flags if they don't truly let you behind the paywall without some kind of like real proof.
Awesome. Thank you for that. That's really insightful. Those are things I'll definitely look out for in future, because the program that I was looking at yesterday didn't actually offer a trial period. However, I kind of have a affiliation with the people selling it because of, you know, past experiences. So there's that obviously no like trust factor in there.
Yeah.
But it's very important, I think, to have that trial, because yeah, like you said, if you should be so confident in the product that you're selling that, you know, these people wouldn't want to get a refund. In terms of testimonials and history, that checks out. But thanks for those three.
And I think it's positioning, you know. I heard something early on, people who don't pay attention. And so there definitely has to be an investment typically that's like, hey, I'm not just, because you could flip that coin the other way too, where you have salespeople just going, hey man, you might like it, you might not, just give me your credit card, give it a whirl. Like, if you don't like it, you can bounce out. That's not the point either, right? It's like, no, I'm confident this is the right fit. I'm so confident that if push comes to shove and you need out, you have an out for the next 30 days, right? And so it's definitely positioning. I don't want to take that too far the other way, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, for sure. And when I was being, I had a coach in my life to help me build a sort of online course, give me some insight and stuff. And he would just say to me, you know, if someone pays for something, like you just said, they will do it. And you just touched on, you know, if they don't pay, they don't pay attention. So how true is that? How true is that in the sense that, you know, I buy a $50 course, like, you know, am I really going to, personally, I would do it, but what is the motivation behind, like, if you offered a free course, for example, what's the bounce rate or default rate rather that you've seen?
Massive.
Really?
Massive. Yeah. There's, so in a previous world, again, we had not only, you know, live coaching, we also had courses. And not only paid courses, a lot of times didn't get completed, much less a free something. So yeah, I would say the statement, people who pay attention, there is, when you have that on the line, right? Especially if it's enough an investment to actually, it's a substantial investment. It's a great motivator. You know, it's like, well, man, I can't waste this investment. So I think it could be really, really key. I think just with courses in general, it takes the right type of person. And this is not going to be popular with mainstream. I know a lot of people who sell courses. If everyone were to actually go through the course step by step and complete it, transformation would be phenomenal. I believe that about most courses. Yeah. Human nature. There's a certain type of individual, you and me may be similar. Like, when we put our mind to it and set it up, like, we're probably going to finish it. Right.
For sure,
a lot of people who have the best intentions, but don't. And so I think that's a tough one. Courses are tough like that.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. Like, I've got the no excuses mindset. If I invest in something, I like to finish everything that I start.
Right.
But the guy who was helping me build my course actually said that sometimes he just gets the payment, and it's not a cheap course either. He gets the payments, and then he obviously has like a follow-up call, you know, like introductory call, and like 40% of his people didn't even show up to that call. They just buy the course and then don't even complete it.
It's amazing.
That's crazy, and right?
It's psychological. I mean, it's just like sometimes if we're not careful, when we're writing down goals, we somehow feel like we're getting something done. In reality, we're not. We're listing our goals. That's great. But dopamine, we can get dopamine hits from doing that and feel like we're accomplishing something whenever we're not actually accomplishing it. So I think courses can be the same way, right? We feel like, oh man, I just signed up for this awesome course. That didn't change anything. You know, you actually have to get in there and do it. And so I think the best courses have supporting live services, right? Hey, I'm going to come alongside you with these check-in points and make sure you don't have questions or you're not, you know, again, falling off the wagon here, and they can be a bit of accountability. And in today's world, there's a lot of ways to do that. Again, there's non-human interaction that can happen too, right? Where you get pinged with a notification on a device or you get an email or, you know, a chat in Slack or whatever it is. So.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm glad we touched on that because I've been pondering online courses for a while now. I've actually created one myself. So,
well, I know it's not popular, but there's ways to do great courses. And I think it's all in how you set them up. And again, the support you give them. Yours is probably awesome. I'd recommend everybody go and get yours.
Thanks, Trey. pricing. What are your thoughts on pricing? Because when I created this course, which is out for pre-sale, I was coached to price it at quite a high enough value. Ethically, I believe that yes, it delivers a lot of value, but I think the pricing that he was recommending, ethically, I didn't think I was giving enough value for that amount of money. Mm-hmm. So I dropped it. So what are your thoughts on pricing, and how do you sort of, you know, choose the correct price for your course or product or service?
Yeah, that can be a tough one. I think naturally we're our own worst critic. And so we never probably put the value high enough on our own products naturally. And that obviously has a lot of caveats. There's some industries that's very easy, right? If I provide you this and it does this to your revenue, I can tell you exactly the value we offered, right? We added $1 million to your revenue. Well, what's the worth of that, right? There's a lot of value in that. Some are really easy like that. Others are complete intangibles, right? It's like, I'll help you be more productive. Well, we can measure that through KPIs or whatever, but like there's a lot more soft value in there as well. And so I think it can be tough. I think I do two things. I look at the market, what the market, average market value. I never think you can go wrong with finding out what a market holds. And then I think having outside perspective would be the second one, is like, after you're done getting through it, pricing it yourself, go find 3 or 4 trusted sources to say, take a look at my offer, take a look at the offer stack, everything that's included, the results we're typically getting. Am I on price? You know, is this the right price or not? I think you can't go wrong with those two.
Perfect. I love other people's perspective. I definitely need to get onto that straight away.
Yeah, send it my way. I'll look at it.
Sweet. Well, Trey, man, I've taken so much from this podcast. You've been super insightful. And thank you very much for your time. I know we had to reshuffle a few things to get this going. Before I let you go, is there any advice you would give to someone, a beginner in sales, someone starting in sales, from your perspective or experience?
Man, oh gosh, that's such a big question. I think two things come to my mind. Find a mentor. It doesn't have to be someone who's, you know, you connect with physically or like personally, it could be online or whatever, but find someone who, that you respect, that you respect the way they do business and respect the way they do business. You can never go wrong, right? And a multitude of counselors is always safety. I think there's something to that, right? Like actually reach out and find someone. I think the other thing is, if you're wanting to get into sales, check your own motivation. Like I know a lot of people get into sales to make big, big money. And that's great. You can make a lot of money in sales for sure. But I think if you're not careful, you can approach it from the wrong perspective, right? I think some of the best salespeople I know, like I said, are curious. They're also really authentically wanted to help people. and provide solutions. And they're certainly not afraid to do that through a challenge or, you know, through being really brutally honest with people. But yeah, I would say those two things, find a mentor, check your motivation, and then go read probably something like, is it Daniel Pink's? Yeah. To Sell Is Human, right? We're all selling. We're selling something every minute of every day, I think, just recognizing what sales truly is.
Awesome. Again, very insightful. Trey, where can people find you if they want to look for you, get in touch with you?
Connect? Yeah, for sure. Website is thescalefactor.com. You can find out more about the seven factors of scale there and what we teach in operationalizing sales and repeating sales motion. Also our social handles, Scale Factor Co. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, it's all Scale Factor Co. And yeah, me personally, you can find me pretty easily online, I think, but Trey A. Donovan, I think on all my platforms. So would love to connect and happy to serve.
Fantastic, Trey. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed the convo.
Yes, for sure. All right. See you. Cheers.
See you.
For more news and content about ThinkConnect, go to www.thinkconnect.com or visit our Facebook or Instagram pages at ThinkConnect.